Well, my notes tell me that we have a school group with us, Columbus High School. If this is correct, would the students please stand? Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much. Please be seated. Well, the students are here on a program called Court with Class that we operate in conjunction with the State Bar, so they know a little bit about the case that's going to be argued this morning. If the students can stay for a few minutes after the argument, oh, you've already talked to them? Okay. I was going to offer up Justice Rebecca Bradley.
And I'm happy to come back again.
That with you. So, all right. Very good. Well, welcome from the court. We're very happy to have you here to observe the oral arguments. The third case for the day is Piper versus Jones Dairy Farm. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel?
Yes, Madam Chief Justice.
Please do.
Good afternoon. Justices of the Supreme Court. Opposing counsels, Mr. Modell, Mr. Phoebus, my name is Bernard Bobber. May it please the court. Along with my colleagues, Keith Copland and Christina Wapichewski, I'm here to represent the defendant appellant Jones Dairy Farm. And first, may I please express our gratitude for this opportunity. Thank you for granting our petition to bypass and hearing directly our appeal of the circuit judges ruling to clarify an important issue of Wisconsin law for both employers and unions. As a longtime Wisconsin lawyer, I recognize that it is a great privilege to stand in this room and speak to you and argue on behalf of a client, and for that I am very grateful. We're here seeking confirmation that Wisconsin is not the only state in the union whose state wage law diverges from the long-standing federal wage law on the primary issue in this case, that is, the specific question of pay for time spent by employees donning and doffing, and whether that can be determined through collective bargaining. The circuit court judge denied our motion for summary judgment, ruling that regardless of the long history of collective bargaining on this that the employees were nonetheless able to recover extra pay for time spent changing into clothes and protective gear supplied by the employer.
Let's start with that. Your collective bargaining agreement doesn't say, the collective bargaining agreement does not say anything about them using that as a bargaining chip or what that time period is or how much it's paid. I know that you allege that that is and has been used, and perhaps it was on the table along with all kinds of other things. But when you started out by saying it was part of the collective bargaining agreement, but it's not in the agreement. So how do we know that that's part of the agreement?
Justice Dallet, the facts in the case are all undisputed. The summary judgment record that we submitted in support of our motion included findings of fact supported by evidence in the record, and none of which were contested by the plaintiff. And in those findings of fact, it is indisputably clear that over and over in successive rounds of collective bargaining, these parties negotiated over the specific issue of should there be extra pay for the time that employees spend changing clothes. And I acknowledge, Justice Dallet, that it is an argument of my opposing counsel that because it doesn't appear in the four corners of the document, it's not part of the party's labor agreement. But I submit that that reflects a misunderstanding of how collective bargaining works and how labor agreements are drafted. I've negotiated many collective bargaining agreements, written many more, and arbitrated even more. And here's how it works. The union comes to the table and zealously advocates for its members and asks the employer to improve their economic circumstances on myriad issues. And that happened over and over in this case. And in the course of the give and the take of collective bargaining, the union will inevitably withdraw some of those proposals as the employer inevitably increases its offer. That's the give and take of collective bargaining that this court, in a unanimous decision in Husco, recognized must have happened.
Counsel, I want to
ask that question a little more broadly than just the collective bargaining agreement. Anything in the record that would substantiate or add support to your claim, for instance, that the wage increase, and we've had several, let me pick one. The wage increase in 1997 was a quid pro quo. We'll increase your wage 90 cents per hour if you forego the donning and doffing.
Justice Bradley.
Is there anything in the record? And if so, show it to me.
Yes, ma'am. Two of the undisputed findings of fact are particularly important on this point. First, our finding number 77, which you can find at the appendix on page 16, shows that the union made trade-offs in its requested economic improvements with the expectation that what happens in collective bargaining is that the employer will respond by increasing its offer.
My question is more pointed than that, though. Of course, in bargaining, you give some, you get some, they want an increase, you want other things. But what we're here today about is donning and doffing. They may have been an increase in 1997 of 90 cents per hour for a variety of reasons. And I don't know exactly what they gave up and you got and in the collective bargaining, but we're not here for a variety of reasons. We are here not for the give and take of bargaining, but specific, you're asserting equitable relief, that there was a quid pro quo. So show me in the record where donning there's anything to support that this 90-cent increase, or any of the others that I have for the other years, was specifically increased with the donning and doffing issue, as opposed to a myriad of other issues I'm sure that they were talking about.
Justice Bradley, the second finding I wanted to point to is number 102.
Okay.
And that's found at page 20 of the appendix. And that finding confirms, without dispute by the plaintiffs, that Jones Dairy Farm, in the bargaining, would not have offered and agreed to the same level of wage increases had the union not withdrawn the donning and doffing proposal and had it stood on its demand for an extra 12 minutes of pay every day for the changing time. And that should not be surprising or remarkable to everybody, because ultimately compensation is the result of a fairly simple formula: your wage rate times how many minutes per day you'll be paid that wage rate. And if the union stood and would not withdraw and potentially might strike over the issue of demanding an extra 12 minutes of pay for changing time, the company could agree to that and simply adjust the wage rate that it is agreeing to increase to a level to make it cost neutral. We could have done that in 2009 bargaining, but the union withdrew the proposal. All parties understood that that proposal was not being agreed to, that it was not part of the labor agreement. They would be paid an extra 12 minutes or 0.2 hours of pay. And with that understanding, the employer puts all of its money on the table and the maximum pay increases that it's willing to agree to.
So is this position, though, inconsistent with your other argument that so de minimis, how could them taking it off the table have any result at all? Do you see those two arguments you're making as inconsistent with each other?
I don't, Justice Dallet. The de minimis argument flows from the fact that ultimately the party stipulated that we're talking about 4 minutes a day. When we negotiated in 2009, the last labor agreement that's relevant to the damages period here, the demand by the union, as it had been bargaining over bargaining, was for 12 minutes of pay. And so we bargained over whether there would be those extra 12 minutes, but I don't think it's inconsistent at the end of the day to say we've stipulated that there's 4 minutes at issue, and under the doctrine of de minimis, that even if found to be compensable, does not have to be paid.
Counsel, I had asked you about 1997, and you pointed to 2009.
Yes.
So can you help me for support in the record that the 1997 increase of 90 cents per hour was negotiated by both parties? Give us an increase, and we'll drop our donning and doffing in 1997.
No, Your Honor. There's no direct tie between just those two issues from the 97 bargaining. You can tell from our brief and the undisputed findings that the argument we made about bargaining history was that it was extensive, it was consistent, and everybody relied on it to understand what the deal was. And I think that the lesson from Husco and the unanimous decision of this court is that in collective bargaining, especially in collective bargaining, a deal has to be a deal.
Counsel, put aside the argument here about what the footnotes might say and how we count votes for a bit. I want, we've got some text to work with here, some text of administrative rules. And I want to hear you make the best argument you can based upon the text and respond to your opposing counsel's pretty clear textual argument that collective bargaining only allows for a waiver under this chapter and provides for a particular kind of process. Would you make the textual argument, please?
Yes, Justice Hagedorn, the collective bargaining agreement waiver provision in the administrative code is 274.05. That's where we find it. And the lead-in phrase tells us that it applies to this chapter, 274. And my opposition argues that, well, that can't then mean a wage claim brought under 272, but that is necessarily incorrect. Husco shows it's incorrect, but I want to speak to the text as you asked me to. 274.05 says it applies to this chapter, which is 274. 274 incorporates, for purposes of its hours of work, in other words, that's wage and hour lingo for compensable time, hours of work, it incorporates 272.12. So 274 determines what's a compensable moment or hour of work pursuant to 272. Therefore, if they bring their claim under 272, it's subject to the waiver provision of 274.05. And the reason we know that from Husco is because Husco was about whether the employer should pay for the 20-minute break period when it's a violation of Wisconsin wage law to treat anything less than a 30-minute period as unpaid.
What do you do with the 274.05 and the provision that says that a waiver needs to is essentially a discretionary decision of the department based upon a number of factors that they're supposed to weigh in determining that, and at least didn't see anything in the record that reflects that sort of thing here.
There isn't, Justice Hagedorn, because of the litigation strategy of the plaintiffs. Our administrative code allows a wage claimant to exercise either option, either bring your claim to the department and allow it to analyze it and try to remedy it, or skip the department and go right to court. Now, the code provides a powerful incentive to drive people to the department first before burdening the court system, and that is you can recover greater damages if you first go through the department. Your liquidated damage claim can be up to 100% of the back pay. Whereas, if you go directly to court and you skip the department, the maximum liquidated damage claim that you can recover is 50%. And so the law provides the incentive, but respects that the plaintiffs can go either route. Here, they skipped the department and they incurred the opportunity cost of having a larger damage claim. They gave up a damage claim to go right to court, and it cannot be, and I think Husco teaches us, that simply because of their litigation strategy to skip the department, that they render 274.05 null. Well, it's left for the courts to decide if the conditions for a waiver, as stated in Husco, are the conditions for a waiver present in the specific circumstances of the case.
So your argument, just so I understand it, is not that this was a waiver pursuant to 274.05, but something of a common law, you know, waiver? Is that a better read of your argument?
Justice Hagedorn, you might not be surprised. My answer is both. My answer is both. We did argue equitable common law doctrines because all of the elements are present here. And in fact, Husco shows us those are tied back into the statutory analysis of 274.05. Please recall that in Husco, there was no waiver that was granted by the department. The parties never even requested a waiver granted by the department. Nonetheless, the court held that it was reasonable for the department to look at the circumstances, and because it arose in collective bargaining, to determine that all of the conditions for a waiver under 275 were present, and therefore it was perfectly reasonable to decline to grant any remedy where it would unjustly enrich employees that struck a deal, achieved other benefits from the deal,
Counsel,
and suffered no prejudice to health or safety.
Counsel, I'd like to do a little bit of stress test on your reliance on Husco. Isn't the reason that the collective bargaining agreement was relevant in Husco with respect to 274.05 is because lunch periods are governed by 274, by that, let's see here, 274.02, subs 2 and 3. Isn't that why 274.05 applied in Husco?
Your Honor, lunch periods are also governed by 272, and I'm frantically looking for the specific provision. I believe it's 272.12.2c, but I will confirm that. And 272,
I think maybe. Mm-hmm.
272 does confirm. Mm-hmm. 272. In addition to 274, but 272 confirms that if you have a period of
Hang on. Which of the administrative provisions did we rely on Husco in determining whether 274.05 allowed for a collective bargaining agreement exception?
I believe it was the 274 provision regarding lunch breaks, and as best I can read that record and those the decision, and neither party either identified or argued that, hey, by the way, there's a too short of a meal period wage claim available under 272 as well. So,
all right. So let me ask you this. Let's set aside 274.05 for a moment, okay? Let's just pretend that it doesn't exist. Donning and doffing is obviously addressed by 272.12 sub 2 sub e, correct?
I believe that's the provision,
okay.
Justice.
So without 274.05, would you say that the donning and doffing provisions of 272.12 sub 2 sub e are subject to collective bargaining?
Yes, I'd argue they are.
What would be the basis for that?
Equitable doctrines.
Okay. Would equitable doctrines also apply to making minimum wage subject to collective bargaining?
Probably not.
Why not?
The minimum wage implicates issues relating health, safety, and welfare of employees that would be considered in a court's analysis of whether it's unjust or unreasonable on balance to decide if their agreement to a deal through a professional collective bargaining representative should be binding or whether they should be able to circumvent the deal and come back for a wage claim.
Right. I mean, actually, isn't the shorter answer to that no. Minimum wage is not subject to collective bargaining.
Correct.
Okay. So why, in both donning and doffing and minimum wages are addressed in Chapter DWD 272 So why would one be subject to collective bargaining and the other not?
We don't have any law yet on the notion of whether the minimum wage piece, you and I are theorizing, and I'm glad to do that, but we have law on the donning and doffing piece. I know federal law is not binding on this court, but when you decide under the waiver conditions what's unreasonable and what's unjust, I think a consideration of federal law, or at least an understanding of it, is important. For 70 years, across the country, employers and unions have bargained this very specific issue because Congress said in Section 2030 of the Fair Labor Standards Act that it was subject to bargaining.
Right. And that might make a whole lot of sense, but Wisconsin can be an outlier if it wants to be, right?
Of course,
okay.
Your Honor. And I think Wisconsin has to make an intentional decision whether it wants to be an outlier or not. When the waiver...
See, that's what I'm asking, though. Maybe it did. Maybe because it doesn't have the exception of the federal law, that Wisconsin has decided to be an outlier on this. And how would we know, according to the analysis that you're doing, how would we know otherwise? Mm. Right? If there's no exception, shouldn't our assumption be that it intended this to be mandatory?
I don't think so, because in the middle 70s, in the 74 to 77, 1977 timeframe, the department put in place the collective bargaining exception of 274.05, and it did that when there was already 35-plus years of unions and employers bargaining this specific issue.
Okay, so then would you say that your position does rely on 274.05 providing a collective bargaining exception?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Can we talk about the equitable doctrines piece, which, you know, I know the equitable piece that you've raised in your brief. I mean, ordinarily, when you're making an equitable claim, our review is for an erroneous exercise of discretion. And so your burden is not to convince us that, you know, on unjust enrichment, for example, that, you know, a benefit was retained, or on lashes, that it was unreasonable. We have a trial court here that made a determination that it would not be equitable to apply these equitable doctrines. We don't get to do that afresh here. If you'd like to ask us to, if you'd like to point out some of your claims that might be more of a de novo review, let me know. But normally, I think equitable estoppel, lashes, and unjust enrichment are reviewed for an erroneous exercise of discretion. So could you confirm that? And if so, make your best argument as to why the trial court not only got it wrong in terms of fairness or justice, but why no reasonable judge could reach the outcome that it reached.
First, Justice Hagedorn, on the first point, yes, I agreement with your statement regarding review of the circuit court. On the second point, quite frankly, I think the circuit judge missed the boat, and his expression of his ruling on the equitable defenses reflects a different understanding of what we were arguing. He essentially said equitable defenses can't prevent a claim from being brought to court and argued to court. And I think we talked past each other at the circuit court level in some way. We did not argue claim preclusion in the sense of a motion to dismiss could eliminate those claims because you simply can't bring them for determination. We recognize they can bring the claims for determination, but that the facts in the undisputed fact record show that as a matter of equitable principles, like estoppel, like unjust enrichment, that it would be unfair to grant a remedy. It is Husco moved from the lunch period wage claim to close changing wage claim. And with my last few moments, I just want to mention that because of the federal law embedded in the wage law across the country, unions and employers have negotiated this issue for decades and decades. There is no state that has a wage law that diverges from federal law on this point. And in the absence of of our legislature saying, well, we do intend to diverge from that longstanding wage law. I think that's an incorrect reading of the law and application of 270.405. I ask the court to reverse the circuit court ruling denying our motion for summary judgment and remand, and with order to grant summary judgment for my client, Jones Dairy Farm. I'd like to, if there are no other questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
I have a question, and that is, you do not contest, do you, that donning and doffing at the beginning and at, let me rephrase it, do you contest that the donning and doffing at the beginning and at the end is compensable? Generally.
No, Justice, I do not. I believe Hormel decided that issue when it affirmed the reasoning of the Tyson case.
Well, I think that Hormel decided that issue also. The difference between the concurrence in Hormel and the lead opinion, I submit, you can instruct me differently, but I submit, because it's written right in the concurrence, both at the conclusion and at the outset, that the concurrence agrees that the donning and doffing is, let me just get the exact language, the donning and doffing is compensable. While I do not join the lead opinion, I agree with its conclusion that donning and doffing of company-required clothing and gear at the beginning and end of the workday is an integral part of a principal activity of Hormel Foods Corporation for which compensation is required.
Yes, Justice, and that's right where Chief Justice Rogensack dropped a footnote and said, Hormel didn't argue that this was governed by collective bargaining, comma, which is permitted by federal and state law, citing Husco 270.405 and Sandifer versus U.S. Steel.
I know. I saw that footnote. I know the lead opinion did not address the issue because it wasn't raised by the parties briefed or argued.
Yes.
But that isn't my question. My question is with regard to what I read to you. That is, do you agree that under the concurrence, that it joined the lead opinion in indicating that the donning and doffing is a principal activity for which compensation is required at the beginning, at the end. The rub was over the lunch hour. That's what Hormel was about. But do you agree with that statement?
Yes. We make no argument that it's not compensable as a principal activity. We believe Hormel did decide that decision. The next question is, was it waived through collective bargaining and the application of 270.405 and application of Husco?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think it should be on your right-hand side to change the height. Is that what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I think
I'll send our marshal over. She knows how to do it.
I think we're good.
If you feel like it's not comfortable, it should get...
Okay.
You okay?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
Okay. May it please the court. My name is Mike Modell, and with my co-counsel, we represent the employees' respondents in this case. This is, as the court knows, a wage and hour donning doffing case that the court granted review on three issues. Since the court took up the what I would call the second issue, we'll make it the first issue, the collective bargaining piece. I guess I'll start there. The initial briefing appeared to be to state that, in fact, what was being claimed is that untethered from a statute or regulation, this court could find a broad collective bargaining exception. I understand from counsel's argument and responses to the court that they're not making that argument. This is simply about whether or not DWD 274.05, that waiver provision, would apply in this case.
Counsel, I would like
to... Do you agree that the plaintiffs in this lawsuit are as controlled by the collective bargaining agreement as the union who bargained itself might be?
Well, I think that depends, right? There are certain things that we know that the union cannot waive and an employee cannot waive.
Okay.
So, for example, in the U.S. Supreme Court, as far back as O'Neill in 1945, said an employer cannot ask an employee to waive the rights under the FLSA.
Okay, but you're not arguing before us that the union did not accurately represent your clients if they structured a contract that did not provide for payment of donning and doffing.
No, I'm not making any criticism of the union, but okay. I certainly would disagree that there was any such agreement.
Okay, I understand that argument.
Well, I don't. So clearly there was an agreement not to pay for donning and doffing, right? That's the subject of your lawsuit.
No, I don't believe that's the case, Your Honor. I mean, we know from Husco how you make an agreement. Okay, you put it in the collective bargaining agreement.
Hang on a second. I need to make my question, I think, a little sharper.
Sure.
So you're here because your claim is that the employees have not been paid for donning and doffing, yeah?
That's correct.
Okay. They're paid according to the collective bargaining agreement, yes?
They were paid, pursuant to the collective bargaining agreement.
Okay. And the collective bargaining agreement does not provide for payment for donning and doffing.
It does not provide either way.
Okay. Do the employees get paid for donning and doffing?
The employees, currently the employees since 2013 have been paid for donning and doffing.
Right, but during the period that's in dispute here, isn't your position that they were not paid for that?
That's correct. From 2008 to 2013 is the period that seeking compensation and that.
And you're not making a contract claim, right? You're not saying that the collective bargaining agreement required payment for donning and doffing, are you?
Well, the claim is under Wisconsin wage law.
So you agree that the collective bargaining agreement does not provide for payment for donning and doffing?
Your Honor, I agree that the collective bargaining agreement does not address in any way whether or not there be compensation for donning and doffing.
Well, if there is to be payment for donning and doffing under the collective bargaining agreement, it would have to affirmatively provide for that, wouldn't it?
Well, under the collective bargaining agreement... No, I'm not certain that's the case, right? I mean, that somebody could have a claim for wages separate from the collective bargaining agreement.
No, I'm just asking as a contractual matter. Do you think that the employees could make a contractual claim for donning and doffing pay for this period of time that's in dispute?
No, I don't believe they can make a contractual claim. They make their claim under wage and hour law.
And that's because the collective bargaining agreement does not provide for payment for donning and doffing.
Correct, because it's silent as to that.
Okay.
Counsel, could you address your opposing counsel's, argument that the provisions, I may not be characterizing it accurately, so counsel on rebuttal can correct me, but I understood him to say that 272 is included, or at the very least the donning and doffing is under 272 is included in this provision of 274. Could you respond to that textual argument that he was making?
Sure. I believe, Your Honor, that's exactly the right point to raise as to is this case even the correct case for this court to be considering as to 274.05. 274.05 is specific that it applies to this chapter, period. Husco was, as the court recognized under 274.02 sub 3, a mealtime case. That's what Husco was cited for. That's what the Supreme Court said this case was about under 274. The pure textual reading of that is 274 applies to payments under 274, not under 272. And there's no question that 272 deals with donning and doffing. And there is no language that I'm aware of in 270, DWD 274, that says that it's incorporating provisions of any other chapter in the administrative code.
What about the argument that's being made about unjust enrichment and the equitable arguments, especially given the factual finding that wasn't disputed, and this is the one referenced on page 20 of the appendix, number 102, that the company would not have been willing to agree to give the same level of wage rate increase in 2009 if the union insisted and prevailed to pay the amount for donning and doffing?
Sure. I think at least two of the justices asked that similar kind of question. That doesn't establish any type of an agreement. What that establishes is that the company unilaterally said we would not pay extra money in there was donning and doffing. That was not part of bargaining. That was what the company has put in an affidavit. That doesn't establish that there's any agreement by the parties.
So you had it on the table. They said no. You took it off the table. They gave you more money. And you're saying now you want more money for it again. There's nothing that appears inequitable about that?
Justice, there were 20-plus proposals on the table. At the end of the day, proposals are taken off for any number of reasons. As the court asked, is there a quid pro quo? Is there really anywhere in the record where it shows that the union said, yes, we will take off the table this provision for donning and doffing in exchange for X? And the answer is no, there is nothing. And if the closest that the employer can represent is, well, it wouldn't have given the money if it had to pay donning, doffing. That doesn't illustrate kind of an agreement.
Let me just follow up on Justice Dallet's question there, and specifically with respect to finding of fact 102. That's not a representation that this is what the company said. This is a finding of fact. It was not contested by the union. The company would not have been willing to agree to give the same level of wage rate increase in 2009 if the union insisted and prevailed on the company to pay an extra amount for donning and doffing. That's a finding of fact. The company would not have paid more if the union had insisted on donning and doffing. And you've not contested that, have you?
Well, the question is whether there's an agreement, right?
No, it's not a question. Justice Dallet raised the question of unjust enrichment, not whether this is part of a collective bargaining agreement. She said she was concerned that the facts as they exist in this case are that the company would not have paid more but for the union's removal of the donning and doffing demand, right?
I'm not sure I appreciate the question, Judge.
Okay. The question goes to unjust enrichment, which is what Justice Dallet was asking about. Isn't there a potential problem here with unjust enrichment? Because the company said, we won't pay you more if you demand donning and doffing. The union withdrew donning and doffing, you got paid more. So don't we need to make sure that you don't get your cake and eat it too?
Sure, but Your Honor, the company, that proposed finding of fact is not that during the course of the bargaining, the company said to the union, we will not pay you more unless you take that off the table. This is an after-the-fact statement by the company.
That very well may be, but if you disagree with the truth of that statement, it was your obligation to contest it, wasn't it?
Well, we can't contest what the company believes. Right? I mean, the company and its bargaining...
This is not about what the company believes. It says the company would not have been willing to agree. That is now a fact in this case, right?
Yeah, I believe that is a fact that's what the company has said after the fact that it would not have done that. But again, that's not the quid pro quo agreement that was discussed.
But the law
doesn't
require that. Does it, counsel? I'm looking at Mitchell v. JCG Industries from the Seventh Circuit, a 2014 decision. It's cited in opposing counsel's brief. There, Judge Posner said employer and union in this case have agreed not to count the tiny donning, doffing times as compensated work. Doubtless the union required compensation for that concession to the employer. And he went on to say the plaintiffs in this case are trying to upend the deal struck by their own union. Do you think that that case informs any decision this court would make on the equitable issues that have been raised by the employer in this case?
I do not. Again, the equitable issues, we talked about what that standard was, which is did the trial court abuse its discretion. What we all know is that there's a specific Wisconsin statute that prohibits contracts to not pay wages. The firm public policy of this state. And
on that point, did the judge here actually exercise his discretion at all? Because my review of his decision does not disclose at all that he took into account the elements of the four equitable claims. He didn't really decide them. He kind of just brushed them away because of the state statute. Is that an exercise of discretion, erroneous or not?
Yes, I think it's an exercise of discretion for the trial court to look at the facts that were before him and to say, I'm now also looking at the law of the state, which is a prohibition of contracts, and can an individual, can you bypass the statutory prohibition on contracts to not pay wages through an equitable doctrine? I think that's application of the facts to that law.
Counsel, do you agree that the union put donning and doffing on the table during collective bargaining meetings?
It certainly was a proposal, Your Honor, and I don't want to hedge only because I don't know the answer to that question, what actual discussion occurred.
Okay, and then my next question is going to be, did the union withdraw the request for payment for donning and doffing during the bargaining?
The union did withdraw the request for donning and doffing.
And the union really speaks, it hopes, for the membership when it makes decisions like this in collective bargaining, correct?
Well, it is a representative, correct, of the...
Okay. And so if I were to conclude that putting donning and doffing on the table and then withdrawing it, so it's an affirmative act, is evidence of waiver, what would you think of that?
Well, I think the doctrine of waiver requires a voluntary, knowing relinquishment of a right.
And what's not voluntary? And nobody's arguing that donning and doffing is not compensable. So you start with a right. The union put it on the table for bargaining. Conversations went on. The union affirmatively withdrew it. I don't know where there's not knowing and intelligent. I figure the union is looking out for its employees. So where does the criteria for waiver come up short?
Sure. We don't know any reason why the union withdrew a particular proposal in the give and take of bargaining.
We don't have to know why. We only have to know they did it, right?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. What we're asking you here is that the court allowed employees not to be compensated based on not a strict agreement. Okay? If there is an agreement, we know in Husco. In Husco, they put right in the collective bargaining agreement that employees would not be paid for a 20-minute meal break, where under the law they were entitled to be paid. It was in the agreement. We know both sides agreed.
I know, but, you know, no collective bargaining agreement puts in the agreement all the things the parties talked about and didn't agree. They don't. I mean,
well, that, yeah, that
and in particular, they don't put in what they agreed not to pay for.
Right, that's what I mean.
Right.
All the things they didn't agree to, you won't find in collective bargaining agreements.
Right, the idea that somebody withdrew a proposal
right.
Is the exact opposite. It's the failure to agree. It's not an agreement.
I'm not worried about agreement. What I'm trying to point out is that waiver is a voluntary, intelligent act by the person who has the authority to waive. In this case, in my view, the union had the authority to waive being paid for D&D on behalf of its members. And I assume you're not agreeing with me, but tell me why, under the doctrine of waiver, the union didn't waive it.
Sure.
Doesn't have to tie it to anything. They just have to waive this right to be paid for a compensable period.
Well, the union cannot waive the right to be paid for this compensable item.
Why?
Right? By law, I can't. Why? The Wisconsin state law is that...
What section of the statutes?
109.
109 is a timely provision. I read your brief and I read the statute lots of times. I don't think 109, it deals with when wages are payable. It doesn't say whether they're compensable or not, and I think everybody agrees this period's compensable. I'm most concerned with why your art... Well, I don't understand why the union can't be held to waiver here, frankly. They had the authority, they had the right, they knew the right, they put it on the table, they withdrew it. Why isn't that a waiver?
It is not a waiver, obviously, under WDWD 27405 for the whole variety of reasons that none of those criteria are met.
Okay. Counsel, I want to explore this idea of 10903 sub 5, supporting your position. If I recall correctly, page 18, or 19 rather, of your brief, you say the case is governed by the statutory mandate prohibiting employers from contracting to extinguish employees' rights guaranteed to them under Wisconsin's wage law. And then you go on to cite 109.03 sub 5.
Correct.
Is there any other statute that you rely on?
No, that's the general statute about not being able to contract to prohibit payment of wages.
Okay, so let's actually take a look at what the statute says. It says, as relevant here, no employer may by special contract with employees or by any other means secure exemption from this section, right?
Yes, that's okay. The statutory language.
Yeah, and the section to which it refers is 109.03.
Correct.
Does it refer to any other section?
No, Judge. Justice, I would say to you that for the same reason under the construction of the language in DWD 274.05, where the legislature is talking about a particular section, that's the section.
All right. So, as the Chief Justice just mentioned, 10903 deals with frequency and timing payment, not what's compensable, right?
Well, it deals with the payment of wages owed to employees.
Okay. The frequency and timing of payment owed to employees.
Judge, Justice, I don't think it's that limited to just the frequency.
Show me the language, then, that broadens it beyond frequency and timing.
Sub 5 and sub 6 are both dealing with wage claims that can be brought for a failure to pay wages that are due.
Yes.
It's not simply if it's not paid within 31 days. It's not simply if it's not paid on the last paycheck. It is for wages that are due and owing to the employee.
Counsel, I have a question. Suppose this court disagrees that 109 applies in the way that you've argued, what would we do with the equitable claims? I mean, one of the standards for overruling an equitable decision is if it's not based on a proper standard of law. The trial court's reasoning was this statutory section. So suppose this court does not accept that statutory argument. How should we resolve the equitable claims?
I would say, Justice, the equitable claims are all based upon this mistaken belief that there is this express agreement. And I say that because I look at the collective bargaining agreement.
I know you want us to. I apologize. Just let me clarify. I know, obviously, you want to win. but I guess my specific question is, practically, what would we do? Are you asking us to undertake the analysis in that situation, or should we remand back to the trial court? What practically should we do with equitable claims if a decision was not based on a proper standard of law?
I believe it was, but if this court were to find that the trial court erred, yes, I would guess that remand would be the appropriate relief.
Counsel, if we don't agree with your interpretation of 109.03(5), do you have any other statute to which you can refer that would prohibit the bargaining over donning and doffing time?
Well, the only way, again, that find a waiver separate from this equitable set of issues talking about is to fall under DWD 274.05.
So let's take a look at that a little bit. So page 20 of your brief, you say, Wisconsin law lacks any exception for excluding donning and doffing from compensable hours worked by contract under collective bargaining agreement. But isn't that looking at it a little backward? Shouldn't we begin with the proposition that the employer and the employee are free to contract for the terms of employment?
Well, they're not free to contract to violate the law.
Right. And okay, so far what you've identified is 109.03(5) that prohibits contractual bonifications of provisions in 109.03, right? But let's set aside, let's just say that I disagree with your interpretation of what 109.03 applies to. Is there any other statute? Let's and presume with me that we're starting with the basis that the employer and employee can agree amongst themselves on terms of employment. And they agree, and let's just further say this, I won't hold you to this, but let's further agree that they decided they won't be paid for donning and doffing, right? So is there any other legal prohibition other than 109.03 that would prevent them from making that bargain?
Sure. It would be a prospective waiver that would not be permitted. It would also be covered by DWD.
Not permitted by what?
By law.
What law?
The U.S. Supreme Court case in O'Neill. I'm not aware whether this court has ever reached that question, whether, for example, an employee could contract at the beginning of their employment with their employer, for example, that if they go on an FMLA family leave, that they agreed to only go for 4 weeks instead of 6 weeks as allowed by law.
Yeah. Okay, so O'Neill is the basis. We're not going to look at 109.03(5). O'Neill is the basis for your claim that this cannot be the subject of collective bargaining. Is that correct?
No, 212. 734.12 says that this is compensable. Okay, there is nothing similar to
272.12. Do you mean
272.12? Correct.
Okay.
That it's compensable for donning and doffing.
Right. But does that by itself mean that cannot be the subject of collective bargaining?
Well, I don't know that we're not saying that whether or not it can be the subject of collective bargaining.
Okay. Are you agreeing that the parties can collectively bargain over 272.12 sub 2 sub E?
Well, what we're saying is similar to 203.0 in the Fair Labor Standards Act. If the legislature were to provide authority to bargain over that and to come to an agreement on being compensated for what's different, either not being compensated for what's clearly compensable, the legislature could do that. We don't have a similar provision here in Wisconsin that does
that. So that goes back to my original question, which is, shouldn't we assume that the parties are free to contract and they don't need legislative permission to do that?
No, parties are not free to contract to violate the law. Similar to when the question was asked,
at the risk of going around and around in circles in an ever-tightening whirlpool, I need to figure out that anchor point that says this is something that you may not bargain over, right? And so far what you have is O'Neill and the terms of 272.12 sub 2 sub E, right? Is there anything else?
Justice, I think you asked opposing counsel whether they could bargain away rights for minimum wage, and the answer was no. When you bargain away rights for time and a half, the answer is no. So the law that the legislature has put in place that you can't bargain that away absent there being a specific provision that permits that to occur.
Right. So I asked them what it did because I want to figure out what their position on it. Now I want to figure out what your position is and specifically what the authority you have, that anchor point that says this is something over which you may not bargain. No, you can't bargain over minimum wage. But this is not minimum wage. This is donning and doffing. So what I'm trying to figure out is what's the legal command that says you're not free to bargain over this, aside from O'Neill?
I can't cite to you the specific case in Wisconsin. I can cite
even if we accepted your argument that Section 109.03 sub 5 applies, there's an important exception that subsection starts out with, except as provided in sub 1. And sub 1, of course, exempts out employees covered under a valid collective bargaining agreement, which suggests that that is something that the parties could contract around, even though the law may make it compensable in Wisconsin. So are you asking us to not apply the exception, even if we do accept your argument that sub 5 of that statute applies?
Justice, I think that language in sub 1 is only as to the specific, that 31-day period, that by collective bargaining agreement they could agree to a different period other than the 31 days.
Right, a different frequency for wage payments, but I heard you say in response to some questions from the other justices that you read subsection 5 more broadly to encompass compensable time, even though the entire section 109.03 relates to frequency of payments. So are you asking us to read sub 5 broadly, but to read sub 1A narrowly?
Sub 5 and sub 6, I said, those two provisions address something beyond the pure how frequently wages are to be paid.
Counsel, just to clarify, I just want to make sure I understand your argument following up on Justice Kelly's questions. I thought your main position was, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that where the legislature has said you must pay workers this amount or pay them for this type of activity, they must do so and cannot bargain that away unless the legislature, through statute or through administrative rule, says they can. Is that a fair summary of your position? Because I'm trying to make sure I understand it, too.
Yeah, that is a fair summary.
Okay.
Counsel, what are the elements of an unjust enrichment, and make your best argument why unjust enrichment is not available in this case?
Okay. Unjust enrichment, again, presumes that there was an agreement that they would not be paid, and the union members would not be paid. If there was such an agreement, one, it would be in the collective bargaining agreement. Two, it would be in bargaining minutes, which none of us have seen. It's not part of the record. Three, it would be in proposals that were accepted. There's no such evidence of that. Four, we would see the agreement. We'd have testimony from the union, for example, in depositions, since this is litigation, where the union said, yes, we agreed to this quid pro quo. Similarly, we'd have something from the employer that the employer said, yes, here was the specific quid pro quo, and none of that evidence exists. Without that agreement, there's nothing that's inequitable about the employees being paid wages that they're owed in the amount of $765,000.
Does that kind of record evidence exist? You indicate there were 20-some things on the table. I'm not sure what you mean by on the table, but I know what you mean by 20. Do any of those 20 things have record support that there was a giving up of one of those 20 in exchange for the increase in pay?
No, it was all the general give and take of bargaining, and this is also not part of the record, but currently what the parties do is they in fact have that specific if get X, give Y. And that doesn't exist. And all we know is that proposals were taken off the table as part of a general give and take of bargaining.
So are you asking us to undertake, I know one of my colleagues asked you to undertake the analysis, but I just want to be clear. Are you asking us to undertake the analysis if for some reason we reject your Chapter 109 argument, or are you asking us to send it back and let the trial court do so?
Can I respond?
Yes.
My red light. Okay, thank you. I don't believe the court has to undertake that analysis on the equitable doctrines because the trial court did so, and there's no reason to believe it abused its discretion. If the court finds that the that did not occur, that the trial court did not undertake the analysis, then, yes, I believe that should be remanded to the trial court to do so.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, as you're going to the podium, I wanted to follow up on the last question, which relates to the equitable defenses that you've raised and what the standard of review is. So if the court were to agree with one or more of your arguments on the equitable defenses, do you think it is something that should be remanded or not? Because I look at your brief regarding equitable estoppel, and you cite a case saying that when the facts are not disputed, it is a question of law whether equitable estoppel has been established. I've also heard you say that we don't have any disputes of fact here. So can you just clarify for me, does that standard of review apply with respect to the other equitable defenses you've raised?
Yes, Justice Bradley. And if I misspoke earlier, I would like to be clear. I think this court should decide the issue. I think Judge Hugh at the circuit court level made a legal determination at the summary judgment stage. I think that's reviewed. Legal determinations are reviewed de novo by our appellate courts and ultimately by this court. I think you should make, based on the undisputed fact record, there are no other facts on which he can judge, and you can, and ultimately need to anyway. So I would ask this court to make the determination as to whether any of the equitable defenses apply here. And I think for unjust enrichment, we're looking at that one. And I think it's particularly apt because in the Husco analysis, part of the analysis about a 27405 waiver is, would it be unjust to require strict compliance with the statute because of the circumstances presented? And the department and then a unanimous court said it really would in Husco because there was a contract. So of course, a collective bargaining contract can contract away employees' rights to paid time because in Wisconsin, under our wage law, a 20-minute break has to be paid time. It has to be. But in Husco, they contracted it away. The department said so, and a unanimous Supreme Court agreed. I'd also like to clarify something that opposing counsel said, as I believe they tried to put a silo of 274 regulations over here to which the waiver provision can apply, and a silo of 272 regulations over here, and never the two shall meet. That's not correct. Immediately before 274.05 is the provision 274.045, and that's called Interpretation of Hours Worked. And there, in Chapter 274, the code says that the provisions of 272.12 apply to the interpretation of hours worked under this chapter, 274.
But isn't that only because 274.03 addresses overtime pay, and you have to know how to interpret hours worked in order to determine what overtime pay is covered?
Justice, I'm not sure if that's why they put that there, but even if so, even if that's why it's here, to connect up the overtime claim, that's the claim in this case. In this case, the plaintiff said, because you didn't pay me for some minutes a day, 4 minutes a day that I spent putting on a bump cap and a frock and a few other things, because you didn't pay me for those, in any week that I had 40 hours of work time anyway, you owe me overtime for those 4 minutes, every time that happened in a 40-hour work week. So they make an overtime claim. That's 274.
Counsel, on 274.05, isn't the concern there with collective bargaining agreements that address safety factors? Is that why that's there?
Well, safety gets referenced as one of the two issues that the department, or in the absence of the department, a court, should look at to determine if a waiver is appropriate. The two issues are, in the specific circumstances presented, would it be unreasonable or unjust to require strict compliance with the code? That's number one. Number two, if the waiver is granted, would that be injurious to the safety or health of the employees? And that's clearly not the case here. The employer requires the putting on of the bump cap and the safety shoe covers and the frock, regardless of whether it treats it as paid or unpaid time. A waiver would just treat it as unpaid time compared to paid time. There is no implication to employees' health and safety as to whether you put it in the paid bucket or not. And it's the kind of thing that is particularly appropriate for parties to bargain over, because the way that employees engage in this donning and doffing is very personal. They go into a locker room where we should not have a supervisor stand and watch them to determine if they're sticking to the task at hand. And the undisputed fact record in the case shows that historically, people intersperse all sorts of personal, non-compensable activity as they put on their frock and their bump cap and their hairnet. They chit-chat. They sip coffee. They look at the Packers statistics. They may do any number of things, and that's why it's appropriate for a union to say, you know what, the employer is supplying all this gear at its expense. Our people need not be treated as paid time for the 4 minutes a day that it takes to put this stuff on. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you both for very good arguments and very, very good briefs. Helpful to us, and the court will now meet in closed conference at 10 minutes after 3. We are adjourned.